Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. I hope you're all doing well today. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode is one that I've been wanting to do for a long, long time. And I managed to do it, which was great. And that episode is DJ Yoda. I got to sit down with somebody whose music I've always been very, very excited about. And I've been privileged enough that he's come and DJed at the club event I run with Scroobius Pip twice now. Yoda's come down. But as we discuss in clubs, you don't really get to chat to people. You just kind of exchange your pleasantries, you know, get them a drink, and then they're off DJing and then they're gone. So it was nice to sit down in a much calmer environment and chat music with Yoda. And it was an absolute pleasure. He was a complete gentleman, as you're about to find out anyway. So before we get on to it, firstly, I'd like to thank Mike Lewis for facilitating it and inviting us into his office and leading us down into Yoda Studio, where we recorded this. And I'd like to thank Scroobius Pip and everybody else at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to 76 for producing this episode. Thanks to My Name Is Ad for doing the artwork. Thanks to you lot for listening and supporting. And if you do enjoy this, then please, if you see us on the social medias, give us a like, a love, a share, a retweet, and whatever else you want to call it. Better still, head over to iTunes, give us a little rating out of 5 or 10 or whatever it is, and subscribe. That'd be lovely, because if you enjoy this episode, the back catalogue is rammed full of episodes with other DJs, producers, musicians, comedians, actors. Go and have a little look, because there's a stack of people, and if you're into DJ Yoda, you're going to like a lot of the guests that have already done this. I'm sure of that. Okay, I think that's it. Oh, I tell you what, if you do really enjoy this and you want to hear more, then aside from what's in the back catalogue, I have a Patreon account, www.patreon.com/offthebeatentrack. And on there, I put up another episode each week. And so you can go and go over there and get more content. And by doing that, you'll be supporting where I'm trying to take this podcast. So any help over there is really, really appreciated. I'm done waffling. Let's get on with it. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with DJ Yoda. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin. Right, we are recording. We are in Hackney, and we're in an office with an amazing studio underneath it. I'm surrounded by serious amounts of vinyl, lots of really cool 80s memorabilia, and the biggest shelf of boxes of cereal I've ever seen in my life. And is that a Bismarcky figure up there?
Yeah, in a cereal box.
Oh, yeah, mate. That voice you can hear is DJ Yoda. How are you?
Good, man. Good.
Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure.
We've had a quick chat already, and we have met a couple of times when you've come to DJ for me and Pip.
Yeah, it's always weird when you've only met people in a club, though, because it's not really real life.
No.
It's very loud and dark, and everywhere is just... I just equate every place like that as the same place.
Yeah.
So
it's really weird, because as much as it's Pip and I's night, we spend 80% of that night outside the front of it. Because I don't know about you, but, you know, I've been a DJ for many, many, many years and promoter and stuff. And you can't have conversations with people in a nightclub.
No, well, you can, but you never really fully can communicate. Yeah. I mean, you're talking, but I mean, I don't know about you, but when I'm chatting to someone in a club, a lot of the time I'm just nodding and smiling and saying yes.
Yeah.
And I've got no idea what the other person is saying. And you just keep on doing that until you get a confused reaction on the other person's face and be like, oh, not yes.
Yeah.
No.
That does apply to podcasts as well. So if I see you doing that, mate, well, look, I'll pull you on it.
Yeah.
All right, well, I got your songs in advance, and as we've established pre-pressing record,
I already can't remember what I sent you.
So, but that's good, because you said that you literally, as soon as you got the list, when I sent them to Mike, who I should say thank you very much for facilitating this, when I sent them to him, within 5 minutes, the list come back. So you'd rattled them off.
I just fired it off. I've got a lot of promo going on at the moment because my album's about to come out.
Yep.
And during that period, it's a lot of people wanting mixes or interviews or answers to things.
Yep.
So I'm just kind of like, bat them away as they come.
Yeah.
So I did do this one really kind of stream of consciousness style.
Yeah.
Genuinely can't remember what I've sent. So let's find out whether I agree with myself.
Okay. That sounds interesting. Track one is the song with the greatest intro.
Yes. Well, that's a funny one for me to answer, because obviously I DJ every week in all these different environments, and a really big part of my, not only my DJ set, but also my AV shows that I do is the intro.
Yeah.
So I'm always thinking about intros, and I always want them to be as epic as possible. And what I've ended up doing for a lot of shows is designing my own intros and kind of producing my own intros to make them as big and as epic as possible. I really like filmic orchestral type intros. I think that's definitely the most powerful stuff. So I do remember what I answered for this one with Adam F and Smash Something.
Great choice. So I've got a little insight into this, purely because one of the DJs that also DJs for Pip and I, a guy called DJ Destruction, and he was someone that I went to school with and discovered hip-hop, and after a few years, the rest of us went off and found other musics and stuff like that. And he was someone that just had the blinkers on and just immersed himself and got into, you know, bought turntables at school, and then ended up doing DMC and doing really, really well. And out of the blue, because Adam at that point was predominantly drum and bass, really, wasn't
he? That's how I knew him, as a drum and bass DJ. Yeah.
And so what happened, so when I see that you chose this song, I thought, I'm going to ring up this, or Ross, not Destruction, I'm going to ring up Ross and just find out a little bit about that track. And he said, like, when they had the album initially put together, like the early parts of it, it was going to be more drum and bass and a little bit more experimental. And then that track become more of an 80s electro style record. And he said, and then when they gave it to Redman, isn't it?
Yeah.
He'd done this vocal for it, and then they ended up developing it again, and then they were like, do you know what, let's just make a straight up hip hop.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, none of that electronic stuff or drum and bass stuff remains as a remnant in any of that album. Yeah. It's a hip hop album as far as I'm concerned.
So they put it back together that become this epic banger of a tune. Redman then revocaled it, and on the understanding, the deal was struck that it could go on Adam's album, but he wanted it on his album as well.
Yeah, because it was so good.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, once something comes out like that, everyone's like, I want a piece of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think they used a real orchestra, didn't they?
They used the Royal Symphonia.
Oh, right, there you go.
That at the time had just finished scoring a Batman movie. And it was all done at the... That was at the Olympic Studios.
Wow, you got all the skinny on this, didn't
you? I have, mate. And but the actual track itself was put together at Miriam Studios in New York.
Right.
And
it comes across that it's a proper orchestra. I mean, yeah. You can recreate all these kind of sounds with computers these days, yeah. And you can get a whole orchestra just from a plug-in. But you can tell the difference when it's real. And that's why I like the intro of that track, because it does sound like...
Yeah.
That's the closest to, like... classical music you'll get me listening to.
Yeah.
Or like, I guess, movie soundtrack stuff as well.
Yeah. So was there any, I mean, having thought about it maybe a little bit more now, would there have been any other, because you can have some honourable mentions in here as well. Is there anything else that...
I really like all the big Hollywood movie studio intros before films. So the 20th Century Fox and the Universal and all those. And there are like weird remixes of all those as well. So I like it whenever anyone remixes those things. What are they called? There's probably a name for them, but I don't know what they are.
You have no idea. Yeah. There must be a name for them. Yeah, yeah.
That, I heard like a dub version of the 20th Century Fox one, which was really cool. Stuff like that. I'm a big fan, like I say, of like, I'll collect kind of shout outs from people and then put it over epic explosions and orchestral stuff. And I'm big on intros and outros.
Yeah.
In fact, the other day I was playing a show and I was with someone who I trust that I can talk to about, they can be critical of me and I can take it. And he was like, mate, I think you need to calm down on the intro a little bit. The intro is taking up most of your set now. I'm 10 minutes into DJ and I'm still doing the intro. But I could do that. I could do like a whole 2-hour set of intro. That would be a cool idea.
Brilliant. Just 2 hours of different people shouting your name over these monster intros.
And then at the very end be like, okay, the intro's over and so's the set. Bye.
Wasn't self-indulgent in the slightest.
Exactly.
All right, so... if I remember rightly, the last time you DJed Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of my favourite intros is, and I'm sure you used it in your set, and I'm going to be embarrassed if you didn't, did you use Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears?
Oh, yeah, I would have done, yeah. That's a similar kind of thing, isn't it? It's just got an epic quality to it, but in a very 80s way.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, I don't... My love of 80s pop is well documented. I don't need to sit here and tell you that I like 80s pop. But the funny thing is with that 80s stuff is that some of it I can kind of separate myself and be like, well, actually, objectively, maybe this isn't very good music, because there's a real kind of rose-tinted spectacles way of looking at the past. And when you've grown up with certain music, you can't help but love it. It's in your DNA.
Mm.
And so what's interesting to me is kind of been trying to, as I'm an adult now, picking apart the stuff that's like, was actually good quality music in the 80s. And I would put that Tears for Fear stuff in that bracket. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's regardless of the 80s-ness, it is actually good music.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really weird. Like, since doing this podcast, they're one of the bands, Tears for Fears, that kind of, when people look back at the 80s and whether you call it alternative rock, whatever you call Tears for Fears, like, they don't get the kind of nods that maybe U2, REM, The Smiths, The Cure get. Yeah. They don't get in. Yet, they were a global stadium band selling millions and millions of records.
But it's funny, you can't put them in as much of a bracket as something like Pet Shop Boys, who are so, like, you, the second you hear them, you know it's Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah.
And they still continue to make music now, Pet Shop Boys, and sound like they always did.
Yeah.
So I think it was just hard to put a finger on Tears for Fears. Yeah. But they, what epic stuff. And it's like, and it has lasted, and a lot of it through stuff like Donnie Darko or, you know,
just of course.
Things that kind of like,
yeah,
you know, bring it back up again.
And to sort of, where I was sort of going with that was the fact that so many people that have been in this podcast have shouted Tears for Fears.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, I think they've earned their stripes, yet they don't really seem to get the props that I think maybe they...
Yeah. Well, I think the track, what I played wasn't really like the original song, was it? It was like, I think it sampled that kind of those epic pianos in it and put it to a hip-hop beat.
Yeah.
And that is pretty much my modus operandi, isn't it? Just take bits and then put them to beats. Yeah. That is what it says.
Seems to work for you, mate. Yeah.
my gravestone would be like, DJ Yoda took bits and put them over beats.
Is that the CV? Just that?
Yeah.
All right, mate. Well, for track two, it's the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, Ramsey Lewis, Les Fleurs.
Okay. I'm not aware of this.
Do you play the songs on this podcast?
What we do, purely because of licensing and whatnot, we have an accompanying Spotify playlist for every single one.
Right. So people have a way that they can hear them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, what was the... remind me what the actual...
The first song that had an emotional impact on you.
So, that's actually was a really hard question for me to answer because it made me think... And realise something about myself as well, actually, that it took me a long time to even respond to music on that level. I think from being a kid and an adolescent, and maybe even beyond that a little bit, I didn't really respond to music emotionally. And I think I learned that as I got older. I think the stuff that got me into music before that, I'm trying to put my finger on it, it's really weird, but I liked sampling and scratching and... this stuff being funny, maybe. So I guess that is kind of an emotional response. Yeah. But when I read that question, like an emotional response to record, it made me think, well, do you mean like a serious emotional response?
Not at all. I mean, a lot of people have said like, oh, and I heard this record and it reduced me to tears. But then a lot of people have, you know, also said, oh, I heard it and it just sounded, it gave me this kind of, it inspired me, an emotion that, you know, fired me up or joy.
I think like it... I mean, laughter is an emotion, but that was probably the stuff that got me into music. I used to like comedy records and stuff that made me laugh. And my favourite rapper was always Biz Markie, and he did songs about picking your nose. And it's not very emotional, but it's kind of quite funny as well. And the first record that I bought was Roland Rat.
We'll get onto that.
I think when I read the question about an emotional response, I thought, well, you probably mean like a serious emotional response. And then, like I say, it took me to, until I was in my 20s, I think. And I kind of, I'd done a proper, like the whole 90s, I would listen to nothing but hip hop. I was really close-minded about it. If it had a guitar, I didn't want to know. If it had a dance beat, I didn't want to know. I was just studying hip hop and hip hop's past and where hip hop was at. And it took until the late 90s when I felt that hip hop was like taking a bit of a bad turn. That was the first point that I started looking into other kinds of music and learning about them. And the first kind of step that I made was to start looking at some of the songs that have been sampled in the hip hop that I loved. So it really meant kind of learning about jazz and funk and soul. And something like this Ramsey Lewis track, it was sampled in a Gangstar record. It's a piano player. It's like famous jazz and Gangstar used it. But then when I heard the song, I was like, okay, this is really different to hip hop for me because hip hop works on loops. You know, that you loop a cool bit and then that happens for the whole song. And something like this Ramsey Lewis track, you get that loop at the start of the track, but then it actually expands and grows and becomes really big.
Yeah.
And orchestral, like that kind of Adam F. track we were talking about. It becomes huge. So it was probably the first time that I'd actually sat down and really appreciated music that did that, which is an odd thing. Yeah, so that's what probably why it took that long.
And my emotion would have been what?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer as well. It's a kind of... is being overwhelmed in emotion?
Yeah, of course.
Then, yeah, that.
Okay. So you said that, you know, by your own admission, you was quite close-minded to other music up until that point, like other than hip-hop. But pre-hip-hop, like, was you just a normal kid that would be listening to what was on Top of the Pops?
Yeah,
and
pop music.
Yeah.
That was the first music I was exposed to. But my parents both worked in the music industry.
Okay.
My dad was a manager. My mum worked for a producer. But it was pop music that I was around, and literally pop artists. I mean, my dad managed the Eurythmics at one point.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like at Eurythmics video shoots and hanging around with people like Eddie Grant.
Holy
like,
shit.
As a kid. Yeah, it was, you know, I was surrounded by it. My dad kept his record collection in my bedroom. So I was literally surrounded by records. And yeah, I would watch Top of the Pops and have the radio on. And the songs that I remember from that period are the ones that I put on the How to Cut and Paste 80s edition. Yeah. That's just the music that I grew up with.
Yeah.
And think of things like Hey Mickey and...
Yeah.
Just, that was what I was exposed to. And it was really in that period in the late 80s when you would get kind of bits of scratching and samples in pop music that led me down the road of hip-hop. So that was the journey, pop, hip-hop.
Yeah.
And then after hip-hop, that was when I got into all the funk soul stuff and reggae. And then... I expanded beyond that and started to learn about country music and drum and bass I got into. I was much older when I started learning about all different types of music.
But going back to being a kid and being on video shoots for the Eurythmics and such, like, was you aware that that was a bit different from what your pals were doing at weekends and stuff?
I was super young.
Yeah.
Super young. I mean, that started... I was born into that.
Yeah. That felt normal then.
So it was just my reality,
you know.
The Eurythmics video shoot that I'm thinking of, I think we were like on some African island or something, and I was probably about 4 or 5.
What was that? By your side?
I don't know. I don't know what song it was. I'd probably work it out by looking at YouTube. Yeah. I've never done that, actually. But I was at gigs. I remember being at various video shoots. I remember hanging around studios. All that was just my normality. So.
Did it feel exciting, though?
Do you know, I don't know that it necessarily did. I was probably bored. I was probably hanging around as a kid, like, at my parents' work, you know, and that's the way that you view it. So I don't know that it felt different or exciting. It just was my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I know when we were sitting indoors playing on our Commodore 64s, none of my pals were on video shoots.
I was doing the Commodore 64 stuff too. That was the more exciting bit to me.
So... Obviously, I like to ask guests, was there music on at home growing up? But your dad's a music manager and he's dumping his records in your bedroom.
Oh, yeah. I remember when Eddie Grant brought out Gimme Hope, Joanna.
Yeah.
We had about 6 crates of the 7 inches in my bedroom, just like more copies of it than you would ever need kind of thing. So, yeah, I was grew up around records like that. Yeah.
Okay, so let's touch upon... I'll tell you what, we'll get to that in a sec then. So let's go to track 3, which is the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I chose Bat Dance by Prince.
Uh-huh.
Which is it does remember. Yeah, you know what? My
secondary school, right?
This is secondary school, yeah. And it kind of speaks to the weird relationship I've got to Prince's music. Because he's like... I know, like, okay, people go mad if you listen to this because I know how much of a Prince fan he is. Of course I love Prince.
Yeah.
Let me preface anything that I'm going to say by, of course I respect and love Prince to a ridiculous level.
Yeah.
But having said that, it never just kind of touched me in the same way as a lot of other pop music and kind of classic stuff like that did. I used to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I did love Alphabet Street loads, mm-hmm. but I think it's just to do with my age and when albums came out. But the Batman soundtrack was always my favourite Prince album, which I know is not a like, cool thing to say or kind of critically, but it is one of these things where you just look back and it's about nostalgia more than anything else.
Yeah,
think about it with Star Wars as well, because Return of the Jedi was always my favourite Star Wars
it's
film.
It's my favourite.
But it's not objectively the best one.
Yeah.
I just remember, that's the one that I remember going to the cinema as a kid and seeing. So that's why it's my favourite.
Yeah.
I know it's not the best. And the same with the Prince Batman album. I know it's not the best.
Alphabet Street's my favourite too, man.
Yeah, but it's probably the same kind of reason, right? Yeah. Like, is it just... I've definitely got this theory that...
How old are you?
I'm 41.
41, okay.
Yeah, and I think that the stuff that you enjoy and are exposed to culturally as a 13, 14, 15-year-old sticks for life.
Completely.
It gets inbuilt into your DNA. There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
And this comes to that category. I remember being on like a school trip on a coach and just pressing play on that Batman album, and we just sung along for the whole thing. We knew the whole thing inside out. And that Bat Dance record, that is an example of like pop music in that era where they started using samples, bits from movies, and throwing in loops, and just, it was kind of very DJ-y. So that really inspired me on the same level as something like De La Soul's first album, or Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique, or one of these things that took loads of samples. So it was really important to me. And yeah, that was definitely of an era.
So where was school?
North London, Highgate.
Okay. Yeah. Did you enjoy school?
Yeah. I mean, I was at the same school from age 7 to 18.
Really?
Yeah. So I was like, I did love it, but towards the end I was like, I've got to get out of this place. It's driving me mad. Like,
yeah, it's a long time to be at the same school.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And had the same kind of like very close-knit group of friends, like three or four of us, and I didn't really deal with anyone else in the school. Yeah. Like they were my good mates.
Yeah.
They were the ones that I listened to the Batman album with. Yeah. And I don't keep in touch with anyone else from school, but I do keep in touch with those, you know, core friends. I did enjoy it though, and you know, like it was school and university was like me learning how to be a DJ, weirdly. Like it's odd to me that I was DJing since school. I was DJing at friends' parties. I was making tapes and everything. And it wasn't anything like it is now working in an industry.
Sure.
I was just doing it because it was fun.
Yeah.
And learning how to make other people experience music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before university at school, like you say, you're doing mixtapes and DJing parties and things like that. Was that something that the school would... Would it, not so much them sort of things, but would they encourage your creativity at school, or was it very much more, you know, maths, English, or was the creative?
I think my creativity was encouraged at school. Yeah, I remember there being like music clubs and stuff like that, and discussing albums and debating lyrics and songs and stuff in a kind of formalised way at school, not just in lunch breaks or whatever.
Yeah.
You'd have after school things where you chat about records.
Yeah,
and I do remember doing that, and I remember just exchanging mixtapes with mates at school, that was a thing. And I still have, like, I mean, you can see in my studio now, I've got cassettes all around me. They're all my cassettes from school. And the car that I drive now, I've got a tape player in it. So every time I come to the studio, I like swap tapes around and listen to tapes. And it's a much, I much prefer listening to music in that way than any other format. The cassette is just the one for me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I like the kind of sound quality of it. I like the fact that it's a real pain to like, rewind and fast forward to the next song, so you're forced to like sit through it. I still listen to the tapes that me and my friends made age 16 at school, recorded off pirate radio in London, and just reggae stuff and hip-hop stuff.
And so at that age, obviously looking at what you've done since and the way that you craft what you do as an artist, was you deconstructing music then, even like the stuff you was hearing, was you trying to work out, well, that's that, and then that, if I separate that from that, then you've got that. Was that something like, but I'm talking pre getting into hip hop.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got mixtapes here that I made using a pause button and my radio.
Yeah.
And I would get the like first bit of the song that I liked and make a loop out of it. And then I'd cut songs up so that I just had the one chorus that I like from them, or just the second verse bit that I like. So it was about breaking stuff down, and I think that my my personality is such that I get bored very quickly. I flick channels a lot when I'm watching TV, and I can't settle on a radio station. I've got to like keep moving around the dial, and so it was just kind of a reflection of how I wanted to experience music, short attention span. And I love the idea from the start of putting little bits from TV programs and films that I liked in with the music. So I would just make this kind of like great big hodgepodge of bits from comedy programs that I liked and pop songs and bits of hip hop. And yeah, that was just the way that I definitely approached that. It's mad because I had this like little Casio keyboard thing that you could sample, really crap quality. Yeah. And I remember getting it for a birthday. And I remember the first thing that I wanted to sample was from Jungle Brothers' second album. It was the first song off Jungle Brothers' second album. And I just wanted to like make the first lyrics on the album go around on loop. And I remember playing around with that with this little keyboard. And now, you know, I record with Jungle Brothers. They're on my new album. And I got the chance to say to Bam the other day, you know, you were like the first voice that I ever sampled.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? And the other thing, like that first period of like getting hip-hop albums, I remember getting the Jungle Brothers album, the Ed OG album, who's also on my new album. It's like to begin with I thought maybe it's like a coincidence that I'm working with all these people that they were the first hip-hop albums. I was like, this isn't a coincidence, I've manifested this, I've made it happen, because that's the first hip-hop that I remember. I want to revisit that and get to it, so I'm literally
touring with Ed OG
in April, you know.
That's amazing. Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. I want to talk about how you got into hip-hop, and we'll follow this question. I think this question will lead into that anyway, but let's go back first to the first record you remember buying.
Yeah, that would be Rolling Rapping.
Was that your entry point to hip-hop?
That was probably was. I mean, you joke.
Probably was.
You joke, but it actually was. It actually was. I liked comedy.
Yeah.
I liked pop.
And
there was this period in the late 80s where there'd be all these comedy rap records.
Yeah.
And they're all piss takes.
Yeah.
But that was what got me into hip-hop. Yeah. I mean, I liked that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was a big Roland Rat fan. I had a Roland Rat teddy bear, which I still got. And I used to watch him on TV, and then he brought out a rap record with a video called Rap Rapping.
And I'm certainly not hating on that because I bought it as well. And and it was, Rolling Man was huge, wasn't he? It was like this.
It was like breakfast TV.
Yeah, TVAM.
And that was when there was like three or four channels. Yeah. So it was.
You get a 15-minute skit of Roland Rat, but in the summer holidays, you'd get like a half-hour one. Yeah. Like you get a little bit more. And yeah, and it was put out a record of rap rapping. I think it went to number one, didn't it?
I think it did, yeah. And in that same period, you had like Mel Brooks doing rap records. You had Kenny Everett doing rap records. The Liverpool football team did a rap
Anfield
record.
Rap, yeah.
There was this whole kind of thing of like, it was really cliche, just kind of like, it was kind of what British people thought American hip-hop sounded like. So it was really cheesy.
And there was stuff like Morris Minor and the...
Morris Minor and the Majors. And my other one, Stutter Rap.
Stutter Rap.
I've got that on 12 and 7. I used to love that song. I mean, that's definitely of the same era. I mean, this is utterly shit music that I do not... if you don't know these songs, I'm certainly
not
recommending...
I'm going to edit this podcast just to this bit and put it out.
don't go out there, seek out these songs and listen to them. I did think about making a mixtape once about, like, of all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I went and visited the music. I was like, it's objectively pretty bad music.
Yeah, it's pretty dreadful.
But it was an entry into hip-hop. I mean, it really was. Because it was rapping and it had scratching on it, and then it kind of made sense of the next steps in it. Yeah.
Can you remember where you bought it?
Oof. It might have been Loppy Lugs in Edgware.
Loppy Lugs?
Yeah, Loppy Lugs in Edgware, which I tell you who worked in there was Richard Russell.
Right.
Of XL.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely bought my first Biggie Smalls 12 inches off him. We've worked that out in later years. Yeah. So that was kind of the record shop that we used to go to. And I saved up and bought turntables. You know, a friend of mine from school's older brother, he kind of advised me on, you want the Technics ones.
Mate, you got 1210s as well.
Yeah, well, I've kind of, by this point, I'd ruined my parents' hi-fi and trying to scratch and ruined a bunch of records as well. But yeah, I figured out that I needed to save up for Technics, bought them, had all my Roland Rat records and my Morris Minor and the Major records and then my dad's records. And then I just didn't have any friends that were DJs. I didn't know anyone that did that. There was no YouTube. There was no way to like work out how to be a DJ. So I probably wasted about 2 years trying to figure out how to do this completely wrong, wrecking needles, wrecking records, and learned the long and hard way.
Yeah, but that's quite punk rock, isn't it? It's like,
I don't know. Yeah.
Learning it yourself.
If I could go back, it would be pretty amazing to have someone to show me the ropes. I think I would have been probably technically a better DJ. But there is something in it, in like learning what not to do first.
Yeah. Okay. So, what was the first sort of records then? You know, let's not dwell on Morris Minor and the Majors.
Or Roland Rat.
When did a hip-hop record come out that you just thought, fuck, this is me?
Yeah, there's a handful from the same period that I remember. I think the very first ones, like proper hip-hop records that I like, were Salt and Pepper, Gangstar's first album, Ice-T, Big Daddy Kane.
Is that Power?
Yeah, it probably would have been Power, thinking about it. This was the first, the Ed OG, Jungle Brothers as well. This is probably like 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand a lot of it. And I think that at the same time, just after that NWA came out, straight out of Compton, and I remember being at Ben Portner's house and listening to the cassette of that and being, oh my God, they swear so much.
Yep.
Let me hear that again. Like, and that was kind of the appeal, was just that they swore a lot.
Yeah.
Like, and I think as a kind of teenage boy, that's really exciting.
I'm a few years older than you, mate. And DJ Destruction, that we've spoken about already, I'd kind of moved away from listening to hip hop, and we used to be able to get this ferry from Tilbury to Gravesend in where we lived. And we went over to Gravesend, like 14, 15 year old kids. And he went to this record shop and he come back and he went and he bought two copies of this 12 that were straight out of Compton. And we went back to his house. And at the time, I don't think he had 1210s. I think he had Citronic decks.
Yeah. Wow.
And he put this on. And like you, straight away, I just thought, oh, I swear a lot in this. But when I heard them horns,
yeah,
I was like, because I kind of like rock music as well, and I was like, this is like heavy.
Mm.
This like,
well,
this...
I felt like that about Public Enemy,
yeah,
at the time, and that was the first time that I remember like, oh, this is powerful. Like, it's there's a lot going on, and there's a lot to unpick.
Yeah,
This is, I mean, you look back now, and all this kind of 1991 hip hop, it was a great year. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. There was Brand Nubian that I remember as well.
De La.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, De La Soul's first album, which this week I gave a talk on.
Really?
Yeah, which was really interesting. Just like sat down and just gave a lecture on 3 Feet High and Rising, which was super satisfying because it does like hark back to that period that I first got into hip hop, and it explains a lot about everything that I've done since personally. Like, it really just got into me, like, to try and make music like that.
Yeah.
Even this new album I'm about to bring out, like, that's the technique that I used was like what I heard on those Public Enemy and De La Soul records at the time, was like sampling and just thinking about, you start with other people's bits of music and then you build on that.
Yeah. Amazing. Track 5, the song that soundtracked your clubbing years.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's a weird question to ask me, the song that soundtracked my clubbing years, because I never was on the other side of the turntables.
Yeah.
Never. That is not my interest.
Yeah.
It's funny that, isn't it? Like, I work behind turntables in clubs week in, week out.
Yeah.
Yet, if that wasn't my job, I wouldn't be there.
I'm really glad you said that, because I've worked in that industry for 28 years now, and the thought of going to a club has no interest for me whatsoever. I'm 45, I shouldn't be in a club anyway, do you know what I mean? Like, unless I'm DJing or promoting. But
when I was 18, I didn't really want to be in a club. I wanted to watch DJs.
Yeah.
I love watching DJs. But in a club, I was never really about dancing.
Yeah.
I was never really about drugs. No, I can't dance. That's why people that can't dance become DJs.
Yeah.
Like, that's a well-known fact.
So true.
I wasn't about drugs.
Yeah.
I wasn't about like losing it. I'm not really much of a drinker. But I was super interested in the technical side of what was going on with the music.
Yeah.
So when I did go to clubs, it was stuff like Blue Note in Old Street, and watching the drum and bass DJs, or Cold Cut and Ninja Tunes, or the Mo Waxler or Giles Peterson. And I was interested in the records and how they were mixing the records and
that's
why
those
records.
That's a great time to be at Blue Note, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And that's kind of the clubs that I remember going to. But when I think about clubbing, I just think about DJing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the DJ. I don't I don't throw my hands in the air.
Yeah.
I'm concentrating.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So on the times that you... Yeah, I suppose you've answered that, really. I'll try and sort of say, ask guests what they wanted from clubbing, but I guess the anorak in you was just...
I was a nerd.
Yeah.
I was a nerd.
Yeah.
Like, that, a proud nerd. Like,
yeah.
That side of things just doesn't... It's not me.
Yeah.
You know, I would rather analyse something or make something...
Yeah.
...than be in the... I'm different with films. Like, you know, other bits of culture, I can very much be the punter...
Yeah.
But I think maybe it's just been, 25 years of being in clubs that's...
Yeah.
But then I think back to when I was 18 and 20 and, that wasn't my interest. Like, clubbing wasn't my interest.
And do you think some of that comes from working in that environment? You sort of see behind the curtain.
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And I think you just, when you're analysing something, that's what you're doing. You can't enjoy it on any other level.
Yeah.
It happens a lot with me with music. I hear something and I'm like, I'm straight away picking apart the production of it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just, that's why that question about like having an emotional response to something is a bit harder with music for me. Because I'm thinking about it in different terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a point where I was like, maybe I shouldn't be a DJ because it might ruin it. It might ruin music for me.
Yeah.
It doesn't, but I have to put on a different hat to like enjoy stuff on a personal level and not on a critical level.
But being a promoter has definitely ruined clubbing for me.
Like,
I can't go to a club and enjoy it. I'm literally watching what everyone's doing and I just can't.
I love people watching.
Yeah.
And I love chatting to people. I'm not antisocial.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather be in a pub, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But anyway, we didn't discuss the actual song that I chose
no,
at all.
No, God, of course not. let's discuss that.
Yeah. Well, it was Black Gold of the Sun, right? Yeah.
The Four Hero Remix.
The Four Hero Remix, yeah. And the reason that kind of, when I think about clubbing in inverted commas that comes to my head is that really the like few years where I learned to DJ was when I was at university. And that was just the practice that I got of playing in front of people and figuring out what crowds want and how to give it to them. And this really dates when I was at university, but the kind of the club night that I was resident at when I started uni there was an acid jazz night.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was the years that I was DJing there that it kind of mutated from an acid jazz thing to trip hop was really big at that point. So it went into that kind of hip hop and trip hop and drum and bass.
What's this, 93, 94?
Don't know.
Yeah.
Can date it by that record, whatever year that Four Hero.
So are we talking JTQ and all stuff like that as well? And the
a bit later than that, I think. Yeah. I think this is like the kind of prime years of Ninja Tune.
Right. Oh, nice.
Yeah, that kind of sound. I remember I would try and sneak in as much hip hop as I could, but then people wanted to hear kind of more melodic, funky stuff as well. And it became a tradition that like the last half hour of the night, you go drum and bass.
Yeah.
And you always end it on drum and bass. That's just the way that it worked. Yeah. Drum and bass was just like, it was a great point back then. Yeah. That was like Ronnie Size and LTJ Bookham and all that. So it was about that kind of transition, lifting the crowd up from this kind of soulful, funky stuff they'd be listening to a much higher tempo.
Yeah.
And that song literally does it. You have like 3 or 4 minutes of just kind of very soulful, melodic music. And then it just kicks in with the drum and bass tempo. And I just remember using that song to like lift the crowd up and then go drum and bass for the rest of the night. So that's, I kind of equate that song with clubbing.
So starting off sort of DJing as a club level DJ, when you first started the club you're just speaking about now, was you comfortable DJing? Was you nervous? Or
I don't think I was really nervous. Maybe when I first started, I mean, I remember my very first DJing in public was in this crappy North London club in like a basement. It was really rubbish in there, and I'd like super planned out what I was going to do with every song. And my mate Damien from school came with me, and I was like playing the songs, and then I put on the record, and then Damien was like, I'm going to help him by like picking up the record off the turntable and putting it back in the sleeve, and he like took the needle off the record that was playing, so it was just like and then silence in a club. And it's like,
oh,
and it's
crushed.
Yeah, crushed. And there's still stuff like that happens because the technology fails or something fails, and it's happened to me in front of huge crowds. Yeah. Like just everything goes silent.
Yeah.
So you still got to deal with that.
You comfortable with it now?
I'm totally comfortable with DJing. Like I don't ever get nervous. It's just not a thing that happens. But I worry about the technology.
Yeah.
So I feel confident in everything that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
But I'm scared that the technology will fail me, and it does.
Yeah. And how are you when that happens now?
You just got to get through it. There's no choice. Yeah. I mean, you can't run.
Yeah.
So you just style it out.
Crouch down in the DJ booth behind the decks, yeah?
Yeah, just hide. Or wear a lizard mask.
That's what you want to do, mate. That's the perfect way out of it. All right, track 6. A favourite song from an artist from your home county or country, I guess. Have you interpreted this as country?
I don't know. Let's show me what I put.
Clever One.
Oh, yeah, that was a clever one. Yeah. I've twisted this. Mm. Yeah. Ah. well, home county is London.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing to like say, what's your favourite music out of London? Because there has been a fair bit of music out of London. So I think my brain just went immediately to what's my favourite kind of music? Probably old school hip hop.
Yeah.
Most old school hip hop doesn't come from London, except Slick Rick does.
He does.
Kind of. I mean, he does.
Yeah.
But he moved as a kid to America.
Yeah.
But that is kind of what made Slick Rick stand apart, is that he had this weird hybrid accent. And he's more, you know, his accent is more American than English, but it's the English parts of it that make him sound cool and different.
Yeah.
That's Slick Rick's first album. I mean, I chose Children's Story for this track, but it doesn't really get much more classic than that. And his storytelling and just the basicness of the beats and... Yeah, that is like 80s music that stands up today.
Yeah,
in a great way.
You've seen him?
Yeah, I can't remember specifically where. I know I have. I think I saw him in the States and not in the UK. I think I saw him in something in New York, probably in about 2002 or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. And so, also, aside from sort of Blue Note, what other sort of venues growing up was you sort of loitering in?
Whew, that's a good question. I really think the first thing that comes to mind are the places where I was DJing.
Yeah.
So even though I was young, I was in these places. I think even around Shoreditch, like 333, Fabric when it first started, Bar Rumba on Wardour Street or Carnaby Street or Wardour Street, yeah.
So is that with Joel?
Shaftesbury Avenue, yeah. In fact, where Charles Peterson, yeah. Yeah, these kind of drum and bass and, weirdly enough, like it wasn't really hip-hop. I was going out and DJing clubs in it. I've always been like not in the middle of a scene. I guess I'm on the outskirts of everything.
It's better to be stylish than fashionable, mate.
I think it's just the way that I operate. Like I never immerse myself in the hip hop scene even so much. Yeah. I was like on the outskirts of it. And the same with a lot of other different scenes. So I would take in a bit of everything. But yeah, that's just the way that I've operated. And it's, sometimes I feel like I'm a bit of an island, but it's given me longevity.
Absolutely,
because within all this time that I've been DJing, I've watched DJs who ally themselves to one very specific sound come up and go down.
Yeah,
and because I don't do that, I'm just my own thing. I just kind of keep on going.
Well, let's talk about what you're going to and what is your own thing at the moment. New record.
New album is literally just about to come out, and it's such a different album musically for me that at one point I was thinking, well, maybe this isn't even a DJ Yoda album. It's such a departure to, I think, the sound that people might associate me with, that I was thinking maybe I need to come up with a new name for this.
Really?
Yeah, and I thought about that for a while, and it really struggled as usual. It's really hard to come up with names for things. And then I just kind of accepted, you know what, this is a progression. Like, I just act in my age. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm trying to make music that is more representative of what I actually would like to listen to.
So describe that a little bit.
I guess I kind of accidentally made a jazz album. I mean, it's like a jazz soul kind of an album.
Okay.
A lot of live instruments on it. It was all recorded at Abbey Road. It's very grown up.
Who have you worked with on that?
Loads of people. Like, I was really lucky to work with like a lot of the people that at the top of this kind of wave of UK jazz that's happening right now. So I'm talking about people like Henry Wu, Nubia Garcia, Theon Cross. They're all crushing it in that world at the moment. And I was really lucky to get them on board. But then legends like Omar, Jungle Brothers, Ed OG, people like Joel Culpepper, Andrew Ashong. There's loads of collaborators on it. And I really tried to make songs rather than just beats.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of melody on there. And it's a very Sunday morning kind of an album.
Yeah.
Very chilled. I'm super proud of it. I feel so more satisfied with it than anything I've done before. Because I guess it just feels a bit more mature.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very happy with it.
Are you generally quite critical of what you do?
Yeah, I am. I can listen back to things that I've done and think they're crap.
Yeah.
But I definitely kind of work with this mindset of like trying to be the opposite of a perfectionist. Just get the idea out and get it out and move on. I try not to tinker for too long, because I think that the most fun part of creativity is the start. Coming up with the idea.
Yeah, of course.
And then the longer you work on something, the more annoying it gets until like weeks later you're like tinkering with the snare volume of, you know, just that bit just drives me insane.
Yeah.
I'm just like, this point is probably not even worth slaving over.
Yeah.
Because the main thrust of the thing that you're getting is the idea in the first place.
Yeah.
So because of that, I don't go back and listen to anything that I've done really, unless I have to. Because it's pretty painful. I have to just like grit my teeth and think, could have done that better.
Yeah.
Could have spent more time on this.
Yeah.
And there are some things that I find unlistenable now.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the other thing that I've been doing in the last few weeks is putting together. So I'm going to bring out a kind of USB with 20 of my mixes on throughout my whole career, from the very start up to the present day. all my cut and paste mixes, because none of them are on Spotify or iTunes or anything like that. The Stranger Things mix that I did, like loads of them. There's 20, and there's some video mixes as well. So I've compiled it all together on one USB that you'll be able to buy. So that it did take some going back and looking at the different things that I've done and trying to work out, well, what do I think stands the test of time and what doesn't? And it's been interesting to assess that.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, you say there's some things that you listen back and you think, oh, God, that's, you know, I wish I would have done that. But then that's the journey, isn't it? It's obviously, you know, you develop as an artist, don't you?
The other side of that is to never get stuff done.
Yeah.
And I've seen that. I mean, I grew up with DJs who I thought were technically better than me and never really made a career of it.
Yeah.
For that exact reason, because they were like, this isn't perfect. I'm not going to bring it out.
Yeah.
And that mindset will just stop you getting stuff done. So you've got to have a thick skin. I mean, I've had people like give bad reviews or like say stuff that I've done is crap, and that's fine. Totally cool.
Take it on the chin when that happens?
I totally. Like, I just got to keep it moving. I'm doing this because really I stop when I'm happy with something.
Yeah.
So if you're happy with something that you've made, it really doesn't matter.
Job done.
Yeah. It sounds like a weird thing to say, but I genuinely don't care what anyone makes of this album.
Yeah.
I know that I am really happy with it.
Yeah.
So it could get all the bad reviews in the world. It could be a complete flop, and I would be exactly the same as if it went the other way.
Okay. What's it called?
Home Cooking. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Just it's jazzy and kind of like quite close to my heart as well. That was where the thinking came from.
Final track, DJ Yoda. A song that many may not know that you would like them to hear. Course it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so like if you asked me to like just if I could just play one song to loads of people, I'd go for Steinsky, Lesson 3.
Yeah.
This is like the stuff that made me want to do this job. It's the idea of just sampling anything that you think is cool.
Yeah.
And that Steinsky record for me was like the genesis of everything that I do.
Yeah.
He just had no holds barred on the stuff that he liked.
Yeah.
And I think what really holds a lot of music back is people thinking, I should make it sound like this because that's what this genre sounds like, or this is what other people think is cool, or what it should be. Yeah. I don't think Steinsky did that. He sampled the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
He sampled like 50s commercials.
He was a bit of a nerd, wasn't he?
A total nerd.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, you've got to be. I think you've got to be a nerd. I think if you're not a nerd, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, why are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That I can think of exceptions to that rule.
Yeah.
But on the whole, especially someone producing, you've got to be a nerd. And what I loved about Steinsky was that he worked in advertising in New York. He was like an older white guy. And he was just infatuated with this burgeoning hip-hop scene, and he would go down to all the clubs and stick out like a sore thumb and just take it all on board and think about all the breaks that they were using and then just throw it all together in one mix that incorporated just the best of everything that he thought was cool. And it's just such a... Here we are, like, over 30 years later, and I still pick apart that record. I'm still like, oh, there's that one little bit or this one other little bit. There's so much in it.
Yeah.
I found that listening to 3 Feet High and Rising again this week as well. Just, it's so dense.
Yeah.
And I love the way that it was done without computers.
Yeah.
There were so many mistakes. And if you couldn't make music like that now, because people would use Ableton and they'd make everything perfect and pitch shift everything so everything's all in key and the snares hit at exactly the right time. And that older sampling stuff, it's a mess.
Yeah.
It is a mess. And I love it. It's a glorious mess like that. You need the crappy sound quality, the dusty vinyl, the bad needles, all that stuff gives it character. I love listening to old blues, the first blues, the blues of the 20s and the 30s. Part of the thing that I love about it is the crackle.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that music would be as good if it was crystal clear quality.
Not at all.
It's of an era. And really, for me, music is an escape. It's like a place to go to. So you've got to have some essence of where that place is in the music. And that's why a lot of current music isn't very inspiring to me, because it's made in a box. It's made in a computer, mastered digitally. Everything sounds crystal clear and perfect. And it doesn't take you anywhere because of that. It just takes you... That sounds like someone messing around on a computer.
Couldn't agree.
And so something like Steinsky, with the pops and crackles of the vinyl and all the mistakes in it, is what makes it great to me.
Amazing. before we finish, what's coming up then? So obviously the new album.
So you've got the home cooking album, a tour that I'm doing with it. That's in the second half of April.
So is that as a DJ tour or is that
live band?
Oh wow!
Yeah. So I've got some of the singers that are on the album: Eva Lazarus, Joel Culpepper, and Ed O.G. from Boston, like this kind of original rapper that I grew up listening to, and a live band. So we're traveling around the UK with that in the end of April. Loads of live dates over the summer, festivals. That's always going to be the way. So
when's the USB out?
About the same time as the album. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure. They'll definitely be with me at shows, but we'll see what we'll do about selling that. But if you just keep an eye on my socials, then
okay.
I'm sure you see me banging on about that as well.
Is there a website?
DJYoda.co.uk.
Cool. Yeah. Yoda, thanks so much, man.
My pleasure.
Cheers. There you go. Cracking episode, right? DJ Yoda. That was a real privilege to sit down with him, especially to sit in his studio and honestly, the amount of cool shit that was in and around that office, it was quite hard. Thankfully, the conversation was really, really interesting, because if it wasn't, it would have been very hard to kind of stay focused, because the distractions on them walls were just unbelievable. I've never seen so much cereal in my life. I've never seen so much vinyl, so much cool retro 80s shit everywhere. It was fantastic. And yeah, so thanks for listening anyway. Thanks again to Yoda. Thanks again to Mike for sorting that out for us. And yeah, we'll see you next time for another episode. Everything else you need to know about merch, about Patreon, about live shows, about everything else, www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. See you next time. Oh yeah, sorry, I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well, podbiblemag.com. It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Me, stew with him.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.